Today on Vox Talks Economics, the third pillar of climate policy. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, coming to you from the first Hoffman Center CEPR Recipe Conference at the Geneva Graduate Institute. My name is Tim Phillips. We're familiar with climate policies to reduce emissions and those that help us adapt to a changing climate. But Ottmar Edenhofer, director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research and chair of the European Scientific Advisory Board on Climate Change, spoke about a third pillar of climate policy that's becoming increasingly important. So when we met, I began by asking, what exactly is this pillar three?
Pillar number three is carbon dioxide removal. So in very plain language, a technological means to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. And you might think, why is that necessary? In simple terms, it is necessary because we already tend to overshoot any reasonable limit for global mean temperature. In the Paris Agreement, we agreed on two limits, the 1.5 and the 2. And the Paris Agreement says well below 2 degrees, with an effort to keep the increase of global mean temperature around 1.5 if possible. In a few years from now, we will cross this threshold, and we are already on an overshoot scenario. So instead of saying, oh, let's give up the climate policy and let's forget what we have done in our calculations about the climate damages, can we find a way to bend the curve of temperature back? When we reduce emissions, when we do mitigation, we slow down the increase of global mean temperature. Achieving the net zero, hopefully, by the mid of the century, we stop the increase of global mean temperature. Mm-hmm. When we then produce net negative emissions, we reduce the global mean temperature. Slow down warming, stop warming, and bring warming down. For these three steps, we need CDR, carbon dioxide removal technologies. It's the only way to produce net negative emissions. And there are two reasons to do this, because how to manage the overshoot. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if people expect that in the future there's significant technological progress in the CDR sector, which is highly questionable, but if this is the case, so then you have more overshoot, and if firms and regulators expect less, so then you have less overshoot. But now we are already on such a trajectory where basically we have no choice. The only thing what we can do is we can try to manage that.
Tell me about this technological progress, because when people thinking about CDR, we often think about these Silicon Valley speculative pieces of innovation. Is that all there is to it? Are there other ways of removing carbon from the environment?
First of all, I talked very much on technological solutions.
Yeah.
Very conventional one would be the combination of bioenergy plus carbon capture and storage. So we have already in Europe large-scale bioenergy plants, in particular in the northern part of Europe. And if we would then basically combine them with carbon capture and storage, we would have produced already net negative emissions, right? So that would be a big step forward. And let's assume that this could be done in an order of magnitude of 300 euros per ton CO2. So this would be good enough at least to compensate the unavoidable residual emissions in the industry sector.
Uh-huh.
So that's a relatively conventional thing. It would need scale up. It would need a lot of application. But the ingredients is already known. Much more speculative is direct air capture in the combination of carbon capture and storage. Direct air capture is, so to say, a technical filter. There are a few plants, by the way, one in Texas, even under Trump, one in Ireland, and one is planned in Kenya. Now, they are basically absorbing carbon around 1,000 euros per ton CO2, which is very expensive. But let's assume they would be able to bring down the costs to 300. This would be probably not the silver bullet solution, but it would be part of a broader portfolio. There are many other solutions, enhanced weathering or afforestation. All these things could be done to create carbon sinks, The problem, for example, with afforestation is that the storage is not permanent. Uh-huh. Everything is not permanent, so this can be used. But if it's not permanent, you have either to substitute a non-permanent solution with a permanent one or with another non-permanent solution. It's an ongoing cycle, so to say. Economically, if you have non-permanent solutions, it's less valuable than the permanent solutions, and this has to be reflected in the price paid to people who provide such kind of solutions.
Permanent is a very long time, isn't it? A lot of these solutions, for them to be permanent, there will presumably be a prices to be paid for the entire length in which they are capturing the carbon.
This is a very, very good question. Of course, the time horizon is essential. And we evaluated in a paper different ways how to reward people for the carbon sinks. There are many ways to do this. You could look at the carbon store and ask the question, is the store in? And if the store is in, everything is fine. If not, so then you have to pay for this, right? This is basically the same with nuclear waste. A crucial thing here is the commitment. Do we really trust that we have a regulatory framework which is long enough to manage these things? I agree. But on the other hand, if we have a time horizon, let's say for the next 100 years, at least if we could store things for a century, just for a century, this would help us to buy time.
Last month, we interviewed Otmar's colleague, Matthias Kalkuhl of the University of Potsdam, about whether we should allow firms to buy the right to emit carbon now, as long as they commit to remove that carbon, when a mature technology to do that exists. When you subscribe to Vox Talks Economics, wherever you get your podcasts, look for the episode, A European Carbon Central Bank, from the 10th of October.
There are different technologies for carbon dioxide removal. Are those technologies more effective or more appropriate in different parts of the world?
Yes, it is. So we did a study where we tried to calculate the comparative advantages. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Russia has an enormous storage capacity. BECCS and DUCCS would be definitely something which could be very favorable for Russia. Afforestation is very good for Latin America. Enhanced weathering is also something which could be used in Southeast Asia, right? So the nice thing is with these technologies, it's a broad portfolio of technologies, but it can also be perceived as a portfolio which is distributed across the globe. So the global South could benefit from that. You might ask the question now, can we really assume that under the geopolitical risks, the comparative advantages of these CDR technologies will be used in a proper way? And of course, we would say no, because we are living in a geopolitically fragmented environment. But for that, I would like to emphasize one thing, and this is quite interesting. So think for a while about, let's say, for the sake of simplicity, about the European Union and about the MENA region, right?
Yeah.
So it would be in the favor of the European Union to reduce oil and gas imports. And we have a mean for that, or we will have a mean for that. In 2027, we will introduce a second ETS, which is called an ETS for transport and building. In fact, it is not an ETS for transport and building. It is an upstream scheme to price the imports of oil and gas. So if we have a reasonable price in oil and gas, this would reduce the oil and gas imports into the European Union. The European Union is large enough to have a price effect on the international market, which basically means this terms of trade effect is in the favor of the European Union. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, we have cheaper oil and gas imports, and we can assume, at least according to the elasticities we know, that the exporters will not flood the market completely. So there is a quantity reduction effect on used oil and gas globally, and also an emission reduction effect, which also is in favor of us. Let's think about the MENA region. So I described nicely why it is so beneficial to reduce oil and gas imports for importers. By the way, the same is true for China. China could join us here. Yeah. And if China would join us, this would have a much stronger price effect. What could the MENA region do? I said it is not wise for them to flood the market with gas and oil. But in order to rescue their oil and gas rents it might be useful for them to invest in CDR.
Aha.
So then you have basically a very interesting situation. The MENA region might have higher subsidies for CDR and lower carbon prices. The European Union and China might have higher CO2 prices and lower subsidies for the CDR. So in that sense, a quite interesting international bargain. And this is, from my point of view, a very interesting aspect on the whole thing. And you could even think a little bit further. You could say, okay, when it is favorable for China and the European Union to reduce oil and gas imports, we could do this not only via just to impose a high price on our oil and gas. We could say, okay, we do this moderately. China and Europe could collect the money and then ask the question, on which part on the planet would be the most favorable place to finance the reduction of oil imports or gas imports or even CDR?
Mm-hmm.
So we call this a jurisdictional reward fund, where we basically could channel money into other countries, which might be much cheaper to reduce the oil and gas imports. We did a calculation and showed that roughly 60 billion per annum could be something which China and Europe could do to finance in such a situation. And this jurisdictional reward funds could be also used by the MENA region for financing the CDR. And this would be a very interesting link between climate finance between North and South and this idea to find reasonable pathways to finance CDR auctions.
How then do we organize these funds? Who administers them? How do they work?
The most important thing is here, this is something which could be done in a quite decentralized way. It is not necessary that everybody comes to the conference of the party in Belém in Brazil and all the 195 countries have to agree on what to do. It could be just a coalition between you and China, and it costs not too much. So this is a very cheap way to cooperate. And then they could announce, we do this in a jurisdictional reward fund. Jurisdictional because this will not finance individual projects. This provides countries money for reducing oil and gas imports or reducing the emissions. It could be facilitated by the UN. It could be even facilitated by the COP, where they have a register where people say, we have a reward fund. We fulfill this minimum requirement to do this on reporting and disclosure and this kind of things. But the most important thing is it relies very much on the preferences of the countries. Some countries might say, we want to finance a public good, let's say disease prevention or pandemic prevention. Others might say, we want to invest in forest protection or in CDR, technological CDR, or in the reduction of oil and gas imports. So we believe that if we open, so to say, the space that countries can articulate their preferences about these things, this could mobilize additional monies and could create some sort of tax coalitions.
Mm-hmm.
And entering into such a tax coalition, not just to improve your own terms of trade effects, but also you have a say in what kind of global public goods countries could and should invest.
Let me ask you a little bit about whether carbon dioxide removal technology will substitute for the sorts of activities that we have at the moment, or whether it will be additional to them. How do you make sure it does not become a substitute?
Yeah, that's a fundamental question. Because if you talk to people, in particular in the environmental community, and make such a proposal, what they say is, this is a crazy proposal, because what you are doing is you substitute mitigation by CDR, and they call have a name for that, it's mitigation deterrence. So you do mitigation deterrence because you avoid mitigation today because you promise something speculative in the future, and this is time inconsistent and it has a huge enforcement and a commitment problem, right?
Uh-huh. Pollute so, now, maybe pay later.
Yeah, it's like what we know from debt, right?
Yeah.
I promise you now and let's see if I can pay back in the future. In that sense, this is a serious issue, a really serious issue. And in the proposal of the European Carbon Bank, we said it is necessary that we control the overshoot directly. And how to do this? You can basically then introduce a type of a certificate, we call this the cleanup certificate, which allows you to emit 1 ton today and to remove it later, and you can back it via a collateral. But what happens then is the carbon price will decline. Why? Because you have less mitigation and you have more carbon dioxide removal. So the budget will remain the same, but you have changed the division of labor between mitigation and CDR. And if you do not want this, what the regulator could do is, because of the lowered carbon price, they could remove the conventional permits and increase the carbon price again. And this comes with a huge benefit. And what is the benefit? They have a much more ambitious climate target in Europe. With the same price, you can be more ambitious. And you can also find a compromise between these two extremes. You allow full mitigation deterrence and you allow no mitigation deterrence. You want to have a more ambitious target. It could be something in between. And you could think about what would be, let's say, a room for negotiation between the regulator, the industry, and the environmental groups. So in that sense, we even thought about a semi-type of a Pareto improvement, a win-win situation. This could be done. But irrespective of the precise institutional setting you need a strong institutional setting, because otherwise it's like creating a bubble or an environmental Ponzi game. And this is something which we have to avoid.
Where does that strong institutional setting come from? Because we have struggled throughout in all the mitigation efforts to create strong, reliable institutions.
I agree. So in Europe, we could do this, delegating this task to a European Central Carbon Bank. Because the Carbon Bank has then the mandate to manage the budget. They will get the mandate to manage the overshoot to a certain extent. And they are the lender of last resort, because everybody who basically wants to remove has to pay a collateral to the bank. And if your removal is successful, so if I'm the bank and you are the company, I will pay you back the whole collateral. And if not, the collateral is mine and I can then finance another removal. It's not a riskless thing. I'm not claiming this, but it is the same type of risk of debt crisis. And we know that there are debt crises, but I would say still the invention of the central bank was a good idea. And in these days, it might be very challenging to convince the public to create another elite type of institution. I understand this. But from my point of view, I think for managing these global environmental problems, we need this type of institutions, because otherwise I don't see why we can basically establish long-term commitment.
For all of carbon dioxide removal, then you need strong monitoring, reporting, verification, standards, and they have to be global standards.
At least European ones, because if European has the standard, and let's assume that we have a negotiation with Kenya. Kenya provides a wonderful DAX plan. Let's assume they will be successful. We could say to Kenya, okay, we allow you to basically to inject some of your into the ETS, then you earn money. But then they could say, okay, if this is done, 1 ton is then on my account. So this is something which I can use then for my emission reduction for my NDC. And 1 unit you can account, or differently. They could say, so we do everything. Everything is ours and you have nothing, but they can use the ETS as a tool to finance their CDR option. And in that sense, if the largest carbon market on planet Earth, which is the European carbon market, if they create the standards and they basically then allow others come in, so they have the potential to set the standards globally.
And one of the prizes for this, it could unlock private capital to invest, particularly in the global south, to be able to solve this problem. But it requires the credibility to create the market.
Yes, that's right.
Ottmar Raidenhofer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You can find out more about this in Chapter 7 of the Paris Report, Planetary Waste Management, a Game Changer for Climate Policy, by Ottmar Raidenhofer, Matthias Kalkuhl, and Max Franks. And if you want to download the entire report, it's called Global Action Without Global Governance, Building Coalitions for Climate Transition and Nature Restoration. Published jointly by CEPR and Bruegel, both the chapter and the entire report are free downloads from CEPR.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, would big push climate policies change our behaviour?